You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, we pick a few of our writers who reads out their pieces in the magazine. This week, we'll be joined by our deputy political editor, Katie Balls, who reads her interview with Therese Coffey, the Work and Pension Secretary, on her plan to get millions back into work. We also hear from Rachel Johnson on the secret cost of lockdown puppies. And at the very end, Jeremy Clark heads off to the races. First, Katie Balls.
If you haven't heard of Therese Coffey, then this will be, to her, a sign that she has been doing something right. As Work and Pension Secretary, she has had to sign people onto benefits faster than anyone who has held the position before. If this had gone wrong during lockdown, she would be as infamous as Gavin Williamson, the Education Secretary. But the system, Universal Credit, managed 1.5 million claims in 4 weeks. Many things have gone wrong for the government over the past few months, but the welfare system has so far held up. Coffey has kept her anonymity. My main task has been making sure that DWP runs effectively. Being in the news would probably be a sign that it wasn't, she says over lunch in the Spectator's boardroom. I'm a great believer in the DWP being boringly brilliant, or brilliantly boring. After just 13 months in the job, she has already lasted longer than her last five predecessors. Some 5.6 million people now claim the benefits, and her next job is to help them back to work. Coffey believes retraining the workforce could be the solution. She thinks that the aviation industry, from cabin crew and pilots to engineers, is ripe for this, given, in her words, the fact that the industry themselves think they are going to struggle for a few years and won't be back until full normal elements until 2023-24 at the earliest. She adds, I want to encourage them to perhaps go into teaching or go to college and to be the people who train the next lot of people who are going to do those jobs. Coffey thinks the social care industry could benefit from workers' experience in customer care, such as air hostesses. She says, how do we help derive to them the transferable skills that they have and that could be working in social care? It may not be their dream job for the rest of their lives, but it may well be very useful. They get more money coming in than if they're on benefits, and it can also provide something really valuable and rewarding. So there are those sort of things where we are going to try and help people think through what it is they can do, even if it is only for the next 2 to 3 years. She also supports Boris Johnson's enthusiasm for air hostesses to become nurses. She says, I'm sure other cabin crew as well who are male can make equally good nurses. It's just whether or not people want them as that is a complete lifestyle change. One of the Tories' big failings in the 1980s was to trap people in an unreformed welfare system, compounding the pain of the initial unemployment hit. As the furlough scheme winds down, Johnson's government is braced for unemployment to double by Christmas, and some estimates point to 4 million on benefits. But Coffey isn't convinced. The Office of Budget Responsibility predicted by now would be at 9.1% unemployment, and we're not. We're at 4.1%. A big difference, she says. I don't want to sound complacent, but we've been doing a lot of measures to avoid the levels of unemployment of 3 million plus from 30, 40 years ago. The Tories, she says, have learned. We know that investing in people now, trying to help them get back into work with skills, lifelong learning, all these things that help avoid the really big numbers that others are bandying around. In the 1980s, she was a teen in Liverpool. Her parents were both teachers and initially immune from that sort of challenge of unemployment directly. But the antics of the council, Derek Hatton and militant running loose with redundancy notices, is what pushed her towards the Conservative Party. I just thought, what the hell is going on? I was pretty young when all that happened, just 13, but it made me realise who ran your council, who runs the country, she says. Margaret Thatcher was doing a great job in the rest of the country, unlike my Labour loony left council, and I decided she was going to be the lady for me, Coffey adds. The Tories now have a new look. One of Coffey's tools is a £2 billion kickstart plan to get young benefit claimants into work placements. She launched the scheme with Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor. He wore one of his trademark hoodies, this time branded with the Kickstart logo. She ended up doing the same. I hadn't worn a hoodie for a long time, let's put it that way, she says. I have a slightly different figure to Rishi. The hoodie currently sits unworn in her department. The job of work and pension secretary has often been viewed as an undesirable one within the Tory party, but it matches with Coffey's conservatism. Helping the poorest in society is one of the core missions of the Conservative Party, she says. As a practicing Catholic who has missed Mass on a Sunday only 6 times in her life, she is more relaxed than most politicians when it comes to discussing faith. One of the upsides of lockdown, she says, was online church services. We just basically did a tour of the UK. I've become quite fond of St George's in Taunton, the St Gerard Magella in Bristol, very nice priests there. Northampton Cathedral is pretty good. A church crawl is a bit different to a pub crawl, isn't it? She asks. But she can hold her own in a pub too, and has a reputation among her colleagues for holding raucous karaoke parties. I ask how she is finding the 10 p.m. curfew. Well, she says it's a perfectly acceptable way of doing it. When probed, she adds, I think you ought to probably speak to Matt Hancock about the big rationale behind it. She is the second longest serving Tory work and pension secretary, but would need to last until the next election to take first place from Ian Duncan Smith. There's a rumour she confronted the Prime Minister a few months ago at Cabinet about reshuffle reports in the press. He told her she wouldn't be moved anytime soon. When I mention it, she blushes and won't get into the details of what was discussed. But she does say rumours of hiring and firings are unhelpful, especially in a department where the lifespan of a Secretary of State is measured in weeks and months. I think it's fair to say if civil servants are constantly seeing that there might be a change in leadership, then it's not that they down tools, they just might not put quite so much emphasis on some of the latest initiatives, she says. And you know, the truth is, actually, I think the Prime Minister has been really good on this. We've got a job to do. Let's get on with it.
That was Katie Bulls. And now, Rachel Johnson.
Book H in for a colonoscopy at a private clinic begins one entry in Sasha Soir's enjoyable diaries about her husband, which should have been called What Hugo Did During Term Time. She accompanies him to his appointment, whether for juicy material or moral support, we are not told, and relates how the bored consultant bangs on in detail, not about her hubby's bum, but about the time his pointer swallowed a budgie. As for their fees, simply extortionate, the expensive consultant whines in conclusion of a violent diatribe against our world-beating veterinarian profession. At this flagrant pot and kettling, Lady Swire flares up. It's a racket, not unlike your game. At last, a point upon which surely we can all agree, Slasher Swire, the bottom specialist, you and I. Just before lockdown, we got a 2-month-old cockapoo, a turbocharged Hamley's soft toy with floppy ears that dangled into her water bowl when her little pink tongue lapped. It was love at first sight. We called her Ziggy, like so many dogs these days. We didn't insure her, even though she cost £1,250. My last dog, Coco, changed hands for a grubby £20 note at a farm gate on Exmoor. I didn't bother with insurance, and she never had a day's illness or accident, apart from the time her tail temporarily went crook after swimming in the icy X, a distressing condition called broken wag. I thought I'd do pay-as-you-go for her replacement. What a fool I was. In June, I ran Ziggy over, or as I sobbed to my wailing grown-up children, she ran under the wheels of my car. A broken pelvis, no action required, except 4 weeks of crate rest. But the x-rays, treatment and overnight stay at the vet in Minehead came to more than £800. Then, at the end of last month, she threw up a peach stone and stopped eating. I was briefly in Greece, and my daughter Millie was looking after her in London. She WhatsApped me a picture, ah, the marvels of modern technology, of the vomit. Video calls between Mile End and Athens followed. Ziggy was draped like some canine expiring Chatterton on the sofa. She carried on being nil by mouth, refusing even water squeezed from a flannel into her clamped jaws for 2 more days. The news is not good, my daughter told us on day 3, as I sat at a rooftop restaurant gazing at my iPhone instead of the floodlit Parthenon. I've taken her to the vet and they've sent me to an animal hospital in Wanstead. She's had x-rays and another peach stone's blocking her intestine. They have to operate tonight. I couldn't help remembering the time Millie's hamster, the late Hammy, was poorly and was kept in overnight for observation, not to mention the three-figure sum I had to pay to spring her slash him. I grimly wired several thousand pounds to my daughter. The operation took place at 1 a.m, and the itemised bill stretched to 3 pages. The biggest item was enterotomy dog, but the general anaesthetic was £200, the catheterisation and whatnot mounted up, so in the end it cost £2,500 to remove one soft fruit hard pit from a small dog's tummy. Of course, when I was back from Greece a few days later for the reunion, I didn't care about the £9.88 charge for only three 500 milligram paracetamol tablets as we panted and twirled in happy greeting. So are we all being sold a pup when it comes to pet care? Half of us own one, but there is no NHS for dogs, ownership of which has gone up by a million, from 8.9 million in 2018 to 9.9 million last year, a count, mind you, carried out before the world and his wife got a lockdown puppy. You either pay as you go or you buy pet insurance. Going by my two quotes for lifetime cover for a seven-month-old, it's around £50 a month with £120 excess. There is a third option, of course, which is you fail to treat, which we will come to. There remain a very few charitable animal hospitals nationwide that will treat, for free or for very little, pets whose owners are on benefits. But during the pandemic, these closed to new registrations. And in August, the RSPCA Putney Animal Hospital, which treated 7,000 animals last year, including badgers and foxes, shut after 100 years. Still, while the NHS became an almost COVID-only service during lockdown, last week we learnt up to 1 million women missed their breast cancer screenings, the private treatment of our pets and animals carried on much as normal for those with cash to splash. When I ran Ziggy over, the care she received from a rural Somerset surgery was immediate and excellent. But as the economy goes off a cliff, I worry about the consequences for those who keep or own or farm animals. The number of animals being cared for by the RSPCA rose from 1,500 to 5,600 between March and June alone. Reports of abandoned pets are soaring, distress calls to the charity's hotlines multiplying. Dermot Murphy, head of its animal rescue team, said lockdown puppies and their like were a source of comfort and support, but warned that pets were not just for lockdown, but for life. We're worried that as lockdown eases, people return to work, go on holidays or struggle financially, he said, we will be facing a massive surge of animal abandonments. I hope he's wrong, but I fear he's not. There is no market mechanism, no mix of public or private, to keep any sort of lid on fees. Vets have you over a barrel. It's a racket, remember? Not just because of this, but because they know we love our pets as much as, if not more than, human members of our families. It has become normal to give our fur babies, awful phrase, Christian names rather than Rex or Fido. The most popular names for dogs this year were Bella and Max. We buy books about dogs such as Monty Don's bestseller about Nigel, a golden retriever with his own Wikipedia entry. When Nigel died, Monty was even invited on Radio 4's Today programme to tell a sniffling nation that Nigel was a bear of slightly limited brain. What he had was this absolute sense of purity. He exuded a kind of unsullied innocence, and we all love our dogs. Everybody thinks their dog is special, he wibbled on. I've had lots of dogs, and there was something special about Nigel. Touching. But as soon as I tell anyone about Ziggy's peach op, they trump me. Ask any pet owner, basically, and they are all battle-scarred veterans of vets' fees. A friend on Exmoor had to remove a champagne cork from Buddy, his 3-year-old cockapoo, at the cost of several thousand pounds. Please don't use my name, he begged me. It's too embarrassing, like a laceration from opening a tin of foie gras. My hairdresser, Kelly, groaned as I told her about Ziggy during my blow-dry. It had just cost her £300 to have a nail removed from her dog's paw, she told me, and every 3 days she has to have it dressed at a cost of £80 a time. At the end of the day, she said over the roar of the hairdryer, They know we're going to pay. Pup date. Ziggy has a 6-inch pink raised scar on her tender belly, but is set to make a full recovery. I don't begrudge the price of a family car she has cost me in the past few months alone. We have, however, started calling her Pussycat, as she's already lost 2 of her 9 lives. But if she carries on like this, I will have to sell the house. Not in order to be able to pay for my own care, nor my husband's, but the dog's.
That was Rachel Johnson. And now Jeremy Clark.
My French friend Andre speaks perfect English and is an unbelievably kind gentleman. After he read last week about my futile efforts to place a bet on the French state betting terminal in the village bar, he put himself out during the week to have a word with one of the bar staff. He gave her my description and told us to expect me to appear in the bar the following Sunday afternoon in time for the big race, the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe. And he drew an assurance from her that it would help me decipher the multiple choice hieroglyphics on the betting slip, or better still, take a betting instruction over the counter. I know next to nothing about horses, other than they are frightened of crisp packets. And it's from experience that they can deliver a terrific kick if you loiter behind them. An uncomfortable truth must also be faced that I have won more bets selected because I like the horse's name than by any other method. The Sunday before last, when I had failed to bet, my frame of mind had been grandiose. I imagined that I had only to listen to my inner promptings and bet large, and the gods would smile and I would be rolling in doubloons and pieces of 8. Since then, that particular manic or neurotic episode had subsided, and I have returned to normal, which is to say, slightly on the sceptical side of realistic. Meanwhile, the seed of my earlier fantasy, a 3-year-old wonder horse called Love, had been withdrawn from the race. In northern France, the rain had come down in steroids all week. The Longchamp ground was stinking soft, and Love's trainer feared that her highly bred feet might stick in the mud. But I wanted to honour Andre's typical act of kindness. So on Sunday, I trotted down to the village bar in a rainstorm with a new bet written on a piece of paper. Being now of sane mind, I had abandoned the ludicrous idea of predicting the first 3 horses past the post and had plumped for a simple place each way bet on the French late entry Persian King, which had been tipped by Colonel Bulging Trousers Pinstripe on the Andrew Pierce show on LBC. This choice was another case of liking the name. Instead of a horse in the starting stalls, I imagined Xerxes at the head of a great Persian host. The barmaid hailed me with one of those French gestures of alert complicity of which they have such a lively repertoire. Only 4 other customers had braved the elements, therefore she was at leisure to walk me through the process. I pushed my piece of paper across the counter on which I had written, Persian King, €20, place, Arc de Triomphe, 4:05. She picked it up and held it close to her face. The furrowed brow and moving lips indicated doubts. Here we go again, I thought. Why the doubt? What was so difficult? The horse's name was irrelevant to her, apparently. What she wanted was a number. Alors, what number was this horse Persian King, she said. C'est pas. Lying on the counter was a sporting paper called Paris Turf. Together, we found the Arc de Triomphe lineup. But it wasn't clear to either of us which column of numbers referred to the horse's betting number and which to the horse's draw for the starting lineup. Once again, I had that sinking feeling of our adjacent countries existing on different planes. She appealed to a sozzled old geezer welded to a nearby bar stool for judgment. After a moment's close scrutiny, he said, the second column. A definitive pronouncement. Number 7, then. Now we were farming. She went to a betting machine, punched some buttons, and handed me a printed ticket, accepting my bet on number 7, Gagnon, to win. On the TV screen, the last horse was being pushed into the stalls. Oh, well, at least I was on. And they're off. Alas, no sound commentary. The varying order of the pack leaders is indicated by changing numbers at the bottom of the TV screen. I'm utterly mystified until it dawns on me that the horse number 7 is not Persian King at all, but a horse called Sopsas. The number seven had, after all, been Persian King's draw for the starting lineup. The old guy got it wrong. So I was on Saltsass. Saltsass, what sort of name's that? In the final furlong, Saltsass breaks clear and wins the richest race in Europe by a neck. 15 minutes later, the barmaid hands me €160. So that, I can report, is the excellent kind of help your novice bourgeois English better can expect at our village bar. You go in, you back a horse each way. The selection is disregarded and you're given a ticket for a different horse to win, thereby halving your stake. You drink a beer, you watch this other horse win. You leave 15 minutes later, as Colonel Pinstripe has prophesied, with bulging trousers.
That was Jeremy Clark. That's it for this week of The Spectator Out Loud. Do join us again next week.